You've arrived at the Takeaway Podcast for Monday, June 29th, 2015. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Holiday vigilance. Ramadan and the 4th of July figuring into plans for possible terrorist attacks this week, according to the U.S. government. Vigilance about the financial cliffhanger in Greece is keeping markets more than a little jittery. And the Iran nuclear talks are also up against a history-making deadline. We'll keep watch on all of these this hour and begin with what looks like a possible summer surge by ISIS. The targeting of British tourists in Tunisia on Friday is the focus of an investigation getting underway today by British and Tunisian investigators into that killing of 39 people at a beachside resort in the city of Sousse. A U.S.-owned chemical plant in Lyon was also targeted on Friday, and in Kuwait, a suicide bomber killed 27 people in an attack on one of the largest Shiite mosques in Kuwait City. Alexander Evans is the coordinator of a United Nations Security Council expert team focusing on extremist groups. Alexander, great to have you back.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So what would you advise? Is this a lone wolf summer surge? It could be a surge, even if it is just lone wolf attacks. It doesn't have to be coordinated the way ISIS works.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be coordinated. But I think what we're seeing is the dividend of what's been a couple of years of intense propaganda activity by ISIS, by some of the other al-Qaeda groups that are still active as well. And particularly we're seeing the yield that comes from all these foreign terrorist fighters that have flowed to Syria and Iraq and that have also helped to radicalize people, for example, in Europe, who are conducting attacks.
We've seen a lot of reports of how that radicalization takes place. A young woman in the United States profiled in the New York Times over the weekend, some individuals who were captured being interrogated in Europe. The radicalization is a very powerful force that ISIS has. But can you see a strategy here? Is there a sense that ISIS wants territory, that ISIS wants to inflame a Shia-Sunni sectarian battle? Is there an overall sense of what they're trying to achieve here?
Well, I think you've identified some of their strategic goals. They want to certainly increase Shia-Sunni tensions. They want to gain control and keep control of territory, not just in Syria and Iraq, but also, as we've seen, in Libya, where ISIS has been on the advance. They're also trying to encourage loyalty from a range of different terrorists worldwide, from Afghanistan to Southeast Asia through to some of the African groups as well. So this is definitely a move to consolidate and to push forward their agenda on a global scale.
Would you agree with the U.S. officials who suggest there needs to be a higher level of alert or some kind of alert status over the holiday weekend here in the United States?
Well, I think each country is able to provide the best assessment of the threat as it evolves. Normally, those threat assessments are going to be delivered on the basis of intelligence. There's usually a higher risk around big public events or big public holidays. But I think I'd leave it to individual countries like the U.S. to determine what their threat level should be.
Is ISIS capable of, and is there any evidence that they might be interested in, shutting down tourism in the Middle East and stifling the flow of hard currency to some of the Middle East governments who can't rely on oil?
Well, I think one country that is of deep interest to them is Tunisia. Why is Tunisia so keenly of interest? It's next door to Libya, where ISIS has a significant presence. It's been the source of many foreign terrorist fighters who've flown out to the Middle East, primarily to fight in the Syria conflict. But it's also been the source of domestic radicalization. So there have been a range of groups operating in Tunisia that have been recruiting and planning attacks. If they can help destabilize the government in Tunisia that does depend very strongly on tourism revenue, that might allow them to establish a foothold in Tunisia in a way that they haven't done yet. They've recruited Tunisians, but maybe not yet established a sufficient presence inside Tunisia.
Let's end on something a little speculative, but there is an interesting sort of contrast here. You've got Tunisia that's definitely under threat, as you say, on the west side of the Middle East and North Africa, but on the eastern side, Turkey. Turkey has a similar tourist industry. It is also an Islamist country, even though it's explicitly secular. It's got an Islamist leader, President Erdogan. Do you believe that Turkey is paying some kind of protection fund to keep ISIS out of Turkey right now, that it's made its own deal with ISIS?
I'm not aware of any deal-making between Turkey and ISIS. And actually, I think over the last year, Turkey's been at the forefront of efforts not just to try and tackle this enormous flow of foreign terrorist fighters, but also really to try and restrict ISIS's ability to import commodities and gain revenue from trade. So Turkey's very much on the front line of this, and Turkey has radicalization to worry about itself.
And it's in the fight, as far as you can tell.
I think Turkey's part of the coalition that's been taking an effort on ISIS, yes.
Do you see any change in what's happened in Syria before we go?
Well, I think Syria, what's tricky is you have the conflict that's taking place there, and you have this overlay of terrorist groups linked to ISIS and al-Qaeda. The longer it drags on, in many ways, the tougher the problem gets.
Alexander Evans is the coordinator of a United Nations Security Council expert team focusing on extremist groups of all kinds. Alexander, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What would you do to quell the violence by the self-proclaimed Islamic State this summer? From Orlando, Florida, a social media campaign to inform and educate about ISIS while guarding against glorifying it is called for. It's not enough to just address it on the news. They are recruiting with the zeal and seduction of a cult. Hilo, Hawaii. There needs to be a dialogue with ISIS leaders. Even if they are a terrorist group, they have pull and influence in their surrounding environment and abroad, and we need to better manage it.
This is Harv from Austin, Texas. The only way to stop ISIS is to stop the flow of money and supplies to them. I'm not sure why they're not talking about that.
Marla from Spokane Valley in Washington State. One thing that I think will help is if they receive less publicity for the horrendous things that they do, they will have less popularity and they will certainly be less well known.
Hi, my name is Scott. I'm calling from Michigan. And I think that our best course of action here is to use drones and strategic airstrikes while mainly supporting the Iraqi military, because it's cheaper in both terms of American lives and dollars, and we are not going to get sucked into another ground war in the Middle East this way.
You can join this conversation by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Unlike ISIS, the mission of the terrorist group Boko Haram in northern Nigeria is unclear or unknown. Their leader taunts Nigerian authorities with threats to sell women into slavery. The kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls as a protest against Western education for women is a brutal, if somewhat vague, attack on Nigerian society. What does Boko Haram want, and who is eager to help them get it? Joining us now is William Wallace, Africa editor for the Financial Times. He says it comes down to a promise of paradise to young men who have no future. Is that about it, William?
Having met some of these guys who've been in prison for the past 4 years and having heard their stories, I think the leadership of the group does draw from a pool of impoverished people, often illiterate, young men who are frustrated and I think essentially bored is what they were saying. And they're looking for a way out. Boko Haram comes along and says they can go to paradise if they participate in this jihad. And I think a lot of those young guys with little education believe that's possible.
What was it like to speak to them?
Well, it was curiously normal. I got into this prison compound and there were about 50 prisoners there, most of them self-confessed members of Boko Haram and other terrorist groups. And they were actually playing volleyball. And they looked like a normal bunch of young men, to be honest. But speaking with them was kind of fascinating because very few people, in the media at least, have had the opportunity to actually sit down and ask them their stories.
And were these people defectors or were they just captured in the course of Nigerian campaigns against Boko Haram? I mean, have they recanted, that sort of thing?
Well, there was one guy who had been running a laundrette business in the city of Kano, and he was a member of a splinter group affiliated with Boko Haram, and he was crossing the north of the country to go and visit his family, in fact, when he was stopped at a military roadblock and recognized as a member of the group. And he then went through multiple detention centers and ended up at this prison where I met him.
You mentioned that one individual was really looking for some group that met his sort of internal jihadist template, some idea that he had, and hunted for quite a while and then found Boko Haram as a perfect match.
That's correct. We're speaking about the same guy here who originally joined a Nigerian group named after the Afghan Taliban, and that group actually started an armed insurrection all the way back in 2003, but it was crushed very quickly by the security forces then. And the surviving members then went to follow Boko Haram, which in its original guise was actually a non-violent movement.
Do these people believe that Boko Haram can be defeated, will be defeated? Do they think that the group is on the defensive in any sense?
Well, we've seen in the last few months that the Nigerian army, together with neighboring armies and also some mercenaries, has had much more success on the battlefield driving these guys out of towns that they held. But what the most senior member of the group, who I spoke to in prison, said was that essentially there was a lot of unhappiness within the group about the current leadership. And he said that one way to end this conflict is to encourage splits within the movement so that the current leadership, which has taken the group on such a path of carnage and destruction, might be sort of toppled, essentially.
You've described the story of radicalization among young men in Nigeria. What is the story of de-radicalization? How does that work?
It's really interesting because a lot of the coverage of this conflict has spoken about the terrible human rights abuses committed actually by the Nigerian security forces over the past few years, and the dreadful conditions in prisons and military detention centers where suspected Boko Haram members are held. What I found fascinating about this program is that it's a kind of the flip side of that. It shows that there has been a very well thought out and serious attempt by parts of the Nigerian government to put together a program to deal with the thousands of combatants that they have in captivity now, and also to actually on the ground in across northern Nigeria to devise a strategy of counter-radicalization as well, which will stop these guys getting into these groups in the first place.
Did you get a sense that any of the individuals you spoke to could go back home and be amongst their former friends and neighbors and family?
Well, from what I could see, the combination of religious counseling from learned imams, psychological counseling, and also vocational training, together with the fact that they've been encouraged to play sports, which Boko Haram bans normally, it is actually working after a few months on these particular characters. But they had been in prison for several years already. I think it's going to be much tougher for the authorities to de-radicalize people who've come straight off the battlefield, so to speak.
William Wallace, thanks so much.
Thank you, too.
William Wallace, Africa editor for the Financial Times, speaking to us from London.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Counting down to the end of this term, the Supreme Court remains divided and ever more bitter, it seems, about the last cases. Today, the court denied a challenge to the death penalty. The court ruled 5-4 that complications with a drug called midazolam were not enough to ban executions under the Eighth Amendment Cruel and Unusual Punishment Clause. The court also said that the EPA must make the potential cost of its regulations relevant to considering having the authority to regulate power plants. They have to take cost into consideration. And the court also ruled in a case on the redistricting of political boundaries, allowing the maps to remain untouched for the 2016 election in a number of critical states. Eric Citron is a partner at Goldstein and Russell. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan, and a guest contributor to the very popular, particularly on these days, SCOTUS blog. Eric, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the death penalty case, because during oral arguments, that was an absolutely impassioned display of very, very different views on the death penalty. How do you think that played out in the actual decision here?
Well, you can see it in the opinions. I mean, the technical question before the court is, as you said, about midazolam and the use of a one-drug protocol to carry out lethal injections. But what's really going on is a debate between the liberals and conservatives on the court about whether there should be a death penalty at all. Justice Breyer, joined by Justice Ginsburg, actually wrote a dissent calling for briefing on whether the death penalty should be abolished. And Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas are writing very impassionately that that would be a ridiculous thing to do, since the Constitution itself refers to capital crimes. But that is really what's going on, and that is why the oral argument is so impassioned and why there's so much writing in this case. There's like 160 pages of opinion.
Let's talk about the technical issue here, because Alito wrote the majority decision here, and basically because the inmates in this case, I believe, asked for an injunction, they, under the rules of proceedings, to get an injunction, they would have to prove that they had a high likelihood of succeeding on their argument on the Eighth Amendment. So Alito and the majority basically said they probably didn't prove that. And that doesn't mean they didn't prove it. It means they probably couldn't prove it. So a different kind of challenge could be a different outcome here, right?
I suppose that's true, but I think it's very unlikely. I mean, in the technical procedural posture, the question was whether they were likely to prevail on their Eighth Amendment claim. But the court's basic holding is they're not likely to prevail on their Eighth Amendment claim because, frankly, they're not going to prevail on their Eighth Amendment claim. Because the court doesn't really want to be in the business of policing the various methods of carrying out lethal injections, having decided that they are constitutional. The court also added an important holding. Basically, in order to prevail, the petitioners were going to have to show that they had some alternative by which they wanted to be executed that was workable. There wasn't actually any alternative offered here because, quite understandably, these inmates don't want to be executed. And in the absence of an alternative, the court was unwilling to just stay the executions on the theory that this way of carrying it out was insufficiently tested or the like.
One more thing on this case, and you mentioned this a moment ago, that two of the dissenters suggested that we should just argue the case of the death penalty itself as being unconstitutional and get over this. Now, does that suggest that the court wants to get beyond these details, or the court actually wants to rule on the death penalty, or the court actually thinks that the death penalty is unconstitutional? Decode this for me.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the hard thing to remember is that we talk so much about the court, but it's really nine human beings, all of whom have very different takes on very different questions. And what I think it shows is not that the court wants to or doesn't want to decide the constitutionality of the death penalty itself, but that that's what's often going on under the surface of these death penalty cases. And so there are justices on the left who are saying, you know, what one more case about how to carry out lethal injections shows me is that we really need to think about whether the death penalty is constitutional at all. And justices on the other side saying, what one more case like this shows me is that all these cases are really about is whether there should be the death penalty at all, and we already decided that there should be. And so I think you won't see the court wade into that question. It's notable that only two of the dissenters on the left were willing to join the opinion calling for briefing on the death penalty itself. But it is on everybody's mind, and if the membership of the Supreme Court changes and becomes more liberal, it certainly may come up.
Let's talk about the EPA. Cost has to be a consideration in regulating power plants. That doesn't mean the EPA can't regulate them. It just has to take into consideration the cost.
That's absolutely right. But I think what's going on here is that according to the power industry, and frankly, as far as anyone could tell, EPA had passed a rule that was going to make it impossible to create new coal-fired power plants at all because the cost was so prohibitively high of complying with the regulation. And that object, if that was what EPA was trying to achieve, is not going to be possible under this rule. But that said, you know, what the court can do in these administrative law cases is very narrow. The best it can ever do is basically send the issue back to the agency to try again. And that's, I'm quite sure, what EPA is going to do. There'll be some other alternative regulation. It may not be able to reach as far, although they may be able to find a different way of reaching just as far. But fundamentally, they aren't allowed to just say it needs to be this clean and the cost of doing so be damned.
The redistricting case is a little bit like the states' rights issues raised in the gay marriage case last week, in the sense that the court seems to be fine with redistricting. It's just in this particular case, there's a commission that in Arizona was going to rule on certain cases. The court says that that commission is fine. What is the meaning here?
Yeah, well, so actually, this is a pretty narrow question relative to redistricting. What Arizona has done is, in order to depoliticize the process of drawing districts, they've given that issue over to an independent commission. But the Constitution says that these kinds of rules have to be made by quote-unquote legislatures in the state. And the question is, if the legislature decides to have, or the people decide to have an independent commission do the work, is that good enough, or does it really have to be the legislature? And on the sort of very technical argument, you had the conservative wing arguing that it did have to be the legislature, but five justices said, no, the whole point of the provision is to leave it to the states to decide how they want to do this redistricting process. And if they want to do it with an independent commission, that's just fine.
Fine. And so many interesting discussions of dissents and people reading from the bench. This court is a very, very lively body as we end the term. Eric Citron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Eric Citron is a partner at Goldstein & Russell, a leading Supreme Court firm and a specialist in appellate practice. So with the latest and possibly final court challenge to the Affordable Care Act defeated in the U.S. Supreme Court last week, the realities of Obamacare for consumers are finally settling down. We can see a couple of trends since the passage of the law: more people insured and overall healthcare costs stabilizing, but we've also seen healthcare providers consolidating and individual coverage eroding. Humana, the smallest of the big five insurers and the biggest provider of Medicare, is looking to sell itself to a larger competitor. Investors in Humana will see hefty returns as the stock closed Friday near its five-year high of $195. But what do these consolidations mean for consumers? And will it affect the ability of the ACA to provide affordable, universal health care? With us is Trudy Lieberman, a contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review and author of the current story in Harper's Magazine, Wrong Prescription. Trudy, welcome back.
Thank you.
So just generally speaking, we can now start looking at what the impact of ACA actually is, more than 2 years since its passage. What do you see are the principal impacts?
Well, certainly you alluded to the first one, more people have coverage, but there are still many, many millions of people who don't have coverage, and that was always intended in the law. It was never intended to be universal. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, estimated at the time of passage there would be about 30 to 35 million people uninsured, and that's probably what it's going to be going forward. And a number of those people are people who are on Medicaid or not on Medicaid. They would be eligible for Medicaid under the expansion of the ACA, but some 20 states have still not allowed them to get coverage.
And that will continue.
We think it will continue. There will be another legislative session, of course, starting in January. And if the Republican governors in the South and the Midwest really dig their heels in again, as many of them did this last session, I think we will continue to see this. And that may be one of the things that has to be fixed.
Well, speaking of digging in heels, let's listen to Senator Ted Cruz of Texas speaking on the Senate floor last week.
I remain fully committed to repealing every single word of Obamacare. And mark my words, following the election in 2016, the referendum that we will have in 2017, this chamber will return, and we will repeal every word of Obamacare.
Let me just say, to me, that sounds like we're past the point where you can even do that. This is a huge impact on the healthcare industry. Does a repeal even work at this point?
I think it would be very, very difficult, and I think the Republicans themselves are very divided on what to do with it. But I do want to point out that in the end, this may actually be a victory for Republicans. The Obamacare law was basically included all Republican ideas that had been in the academic literature for at least two decades before passage. And it also continues to bake in a trend that conservatives and Republicans have wanted, and that is to shift more of the cost of rising health care costs to consumers.
So consumers will be paying more individually, even though the cost of health care may be stabilizing in the aggregate. And so Democrats crowing about the Affordable Care Act, like Nancy Pelosi here, maybe that's not valid.
Let me read what the chief wrote. Chief Justice John Roberts: Congress passed the Affordable Care Act to improve health insurance markets, not to destroy them. That's just one sentence. It's really quite a good decision in terms of how it speaks about the Affordable Care Act. So they'll keep trying, and we'll keep fighting.
So has the ACA improved health insurance markets?
It has, in a very narrow sense. I think we have to think about this. People who were sick before and who had disabilities and so forth could not buy insurance in the individual marketplace. It was very expensive if they could buy it at all. That has been fixed. They can buy insurance now. But that also means for the companies that lots of people who are ill and have very expensive claims are coming into the risk pools. And we are still not sure how that's all going to shake out. And there are many people who predict very high increases coming in the next couple of years. One of the reasons is that healthcare costs are on the rise again.
And what about consolidation? As Humana gets bought, as some of these companies, Anthem, become bigger and bigger and bigger, do they outvote the federal government in their ability to set prices and raise premiums?
Well, certainly consolidation on both sides, the insurer side and on the provider side, doesn't really help lower costs very much. They may claim that it does in terms of whatever efficiency means, and you often hear that word. But we've seen in market after market that what tends to happen is the big players have the information to control the market.
So it's kind of a radical idea, but what you're suggesting here is that the Affordable Care Act is a self-repealing bill in the sense that as time goes on, costs will get higher and the same problems that consumers had before the ACA are going to get worse under the ACA. Is that about right?
I think that's correct. I think what we're going to see, and a number of people told me that as I was preparing the Harper's article, that we are going to replace the crisis of uninsurance with a new crisis of underinsurance.
And how is that going to work for an individual consumer? What's the situation? Let's say I'm, you know, in my 40s when I bought ACA insurance in the marketplace, and then suddenly something happens to me in my late 50s. What am I going to discover?
Well, you can still get a policy. I don't think that ever is going to change. I think that is baked in the law now. You will be able to get coverage, but you may pay a lot of money for it because inevitably medical costs will continue to rise. The question is long term whether they will continue to rise as fast as they were at some points in the last decade, and a lot of people think they will.
Do consumers have any discretion in extending their coverage and making more of a safety net for themselves, or is that something that is still not affordable?
Well, they have to buy a policy every year. They have to renew. People in the ACA renew their policies every year, and of course they have the right to shop around. And the question is, what will those markets look like? They already have very narrow choices in some parts of the country and in some regions of the country. People don't have much of a choice. In other areas of the country, like here in New York City, they have a lot of choice. The question is, how much choice ultimately will people have?
Trudy Lieberman is a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and author of the current piece in Harper's Wrong Prescription, which dissects what's wrong with the Affordable Care Act and what needs to be fixed. Your reactions to the Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act are still coming in. Trudy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Ken writes on our Facebook page, I hear many speaking of insurance being higher on some policies than before. Somehow this is viewed as the fault of the law, but no proof is offered. Seems to me a good target for a congressional investigation would be why insurance and drug companies increase costs when, by all logic, they should be decreasing them. Keep the conversation going at 8778-MY-TAKE. That's our number, or comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Everyone deserves the right to get married and live happily ever after.
This morning, the Supreme Court recognized that the Constitution guarantees marriage equality. In doing so, they've reaffirmed that all Americans are entitled to the equal protection of the law, that all people should be treated equally, regardless of who they are or who they love.
President Obama heralding on Friday the Supreme Court ruling affirming gay marriage. The decision noted how far marriage has come in the history of civilization, that the institution was once a symbol of the bondage of brides and grooms, devoid of any emotional component. Love certainly had nothing to do with it. Stephanie Kuntz is the author of the new book, Marriage, A History: How Love Conquered Marriage. She says the original bells you might hear at a wedding would sound more like ka-ching than this.
Marriage was far too important a political and economic institution. It's the way that the upper class signed peace treaties and, you know, made war. It's the way that the middle class got business arrangements. For the lower classes, it was the way you got your working partner. Bakers had to marry other bakers, even if they fell in love with somebody who did something else, because you couldn't run a small business without it. Farmers had to marry someone with fields nearby and who was a good worker. So love was considered something that was really kind of different from marriage. Okay, if you fell in love after marriage, but not really the purpose. And there were many places in Europe, in southern France, for example, the idea was that the only place you could find true love was in adultery, because marriage was such a mercenary institution. So adding love to marriage was a big revolutionary change.
In America, how did the impulse of freedom go from being this kind of disruptive impulse in marriage and other institutions to being this icon of traditionalism in the 1950s?
Well, that's a very interesting evolution, because when the idea of love first came out, people were terrified. They said, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to society if my son can say, oh, I don't want to marry that woman, I don't love her? Or what's going to happen when people fall out of love? They're going to want divorce. A woman who was seduced might even refuse to get married. People were really worried about this. But the way they initially handled it, well, there were two ways. One was, you really couldn't escape marriage as long as women were economically and legally dependent on men. And there was a lot of social pressure from elites. It could penalize people who didn't marry or who got divorced. And as late as the 1950s and 60s, so a man who wasn't married or who was divorced was often passed over for a promotion, and a woman was just basically nowhere. But the other way that they, and this is a real major problem for us today when we think about trying to build marriages and sustain marriages based on love, the other way that they tried to finesse the problems was to redefine love as the union of opposites. You fell in love with someone who was totally different from you, and you had to stay together because you couldn't have access to the emotions, the skills, the resources. So here we are today trying to build marriages on the basis of love, but we have two historical definitions of love. One is that it's illicit and exciting because it's illicit. The other is that it's of opposites.
So the Leave It to Beaver, you know, Donna Reed show, Dick Van Dyke show image of the American marriage, and of course that's, you know, all white, is an enshrinement of this idea that, you know, women do one thing and men do another thing, and those are the people you fall in love with, as opposed to recognizing the diversity of our emotions and that all kinds of people fall in love. And in fact, this tradition of the 50s was so fragile, it never had a chance to succeed in the 21st century.
Absolutely. People look back to that as the traditional family. But actually, it was probably the only time in history when a vast majority of women did not work, did not work on farms beside their husbands or work in small businesses, when a man could support a family on his own earnings instead of having child labor. So the male breadwinner family is not the least bit traditional, and it was organized around these very rigid gender roles. You know, back in the 1950s, the average couple married after knowing each other for only 6 months. And, you know, from our modern perspective, how do you get to know a person as an individual? Well, you know, you don't. You in many cases, now, some people were very lucky, of course, and they did become friends and were able to sustain their marriages. But basically, you married a gender stereotype, and you didn't have a lot to negotiate because it was the man who earned the money, the woman had to depend on him, and all of the messages of the day were that the woman had to adjust to the man's interests. Unlike today, when men and women come in with equal experience, they're both older, more mature, and you have to adjust to each other's.
So how do you view the transition here in the United States of acceptance of same-sex marriage as a civil rights transition that a lot of people describe it as? And of course, the Supreme Court, you know, makes it a legal matter. Or is it part of a broader redefinition of marriage in the face of profoundly different realities in the 21st century from the 1950s?
Well, I think the second is what's there. And I think one of the amusing ironies in all this debate, when people say, oh, my goodness, same-sex marriage will change heterosexual marriage, it's a whole revolution. Actually, the revolution was started by heterosexuals. Heterosexuals were the ones who first said, well, marriage should be about love. And in the late 18th century. And in the early 20th century, we added to this the idea, well, marriage should be based on sexual attraction and sexual fulfillment. In the 1950s and 60s, in the 1950s, it was still very difficult not to have a kid. But then we said, okay, you can marry and you don't have to have a kid. And then we said, if you can have kids, we'll let you have assisted reproduction, which used to be called adultery, and children born from assisted reproduction were considered illegitimate. And so, you know, all of these things began to change the definition of marriage in ways that gays and lesbians were saying, this begins to apply to us. And the final blow was in the 1970s when we repealed all of the laws that said men have one set of duties and they have to perform these, and women have a different set of duties and they should only perform these. We said marriage is an association of two individuals who can choose for themselves what roles they want to play in the marriage. And at this point, I think it was almost inevitable that gays and lesbians would say, hey, you have redefined marriage so much that it's now something we can and should be able to enter.
Stephanie Kuntz is the author of Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. She's a professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families. Stephanie, thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
And here's something to take with you today. Actually, three little nuggets. He can afford it. Elon Musk lost a rocket over the weekend. You should check out the pictures on the internet. His SpaceX vehicle exploded about 2 minutes into a mission that was supposed to resupply the International Space Station. Cause unknown. Better luck next time. The two escaped convicts who eluded authorities for nearly 2 weeks in New York State may have covered their trail with sniffing dog repellent pepper. According to a source in the Christian Science Monitor, the technique was actually used in the movie Cool Hand Luke. And finally, a woman running for president is a fact, but what woman's face should go on the $10 bill is a big deal right now on social media. Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosa Parks, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth. What about your mom? They're all contenders. That's all for today, but we want you to take the takeaway with you. Subscribe to our podcast. Do it today. You can find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. We'll settle you down. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation. For increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.